economy in disarray. Fiscal and monetary reforms that had been earlier contemplated, even on a limited scale, also were met with laxity and nonchalance. The powerful class of government accountants, the Mustophys, jealously guarded their trade secrets and resisted a centralized revenue and expenditure regime. The Ministry of Finance, Maliye, created in the early 1860s on the Ottoman model, proved largely window dressing, with minimal operational control over the Mustophys. It was neither capable of implementing an efficient fiscal policy nor able to put an end to bickering between the rival factions. By the very end of the Nasseri period, the Qajar statesmen still could not clearly or permanently differentiate the government treasury from the Shah's own private purse, the latter normally administered by some trusted wife of the Shah, one of the many whom he kept busy with a variety of semi-official tasks. Even basic measures introduced by Amir Kabir were left to wither. The practice of annually auctioning off provincial posts to the highest bidder was more damaging than beneficial for efficient governance of the provinces. From the late 1860s, the Shah pursued the sale of offices with greater vigour once his senior uncles were no longer in full control of provincial posts. The sale of provincial posts were intended to maximise revenue rather than bar governors from laying roots in provincial seats, a policy leading to increased abuse over the decades. Often irrespective of the suitability of the appointee or the methods of tax collection, and to the detriment of the peasants who ultimately bore the burden, the Shah and his ministers received in advance a fixed sum in exchange for approving a candidate to office. The appointees to these revolving-door governorships came from a small clique of princes of the royal family, ranking bureaucrats and court hangers-on. They bid for these offices in the expectation of regaining their investment plus a handsome profit, which was essentially the royally approved form of extortion. Even if the appointees were experienced and merciful souls, often the unrealistically high monetary commitments that they made to the central treasury left little room but for them to pressure the district governors and their menacing tax collectors. They were responsible for extracting taxes from the peasantry, at times up to their last penny or the last bag of fodder for their donkeys. The landowners, who were mostly local nobility and tribal chiefs, often bore little or no responsibility for honouring their share of taxes and offered little, if any, shelter to their peasants from the state's tax collectors. Once the landlords took their share from the harvest, based on a sharecropping arrangement, the field was open for government agents to collect, and by means of physical punishment if necessary. Crop failure because of droughts, locusts, or other natural disasters occasionally exempted villagers, but not always. It was not uncommon that villagers would evade the tax collectors by taking refuge in the mountains or hiding in underground shelters, even at the expense of losing their crops and livestock, their livelihood. Yet, despite all the harsh measures, the voracious governors not infrequently ended their annual term with a loss, collecting less than they paid the state's treasury. Although from the 1860s, improved security and reduced troop movements, which often relied on villagers for provisions, brought greater prosperity, they did not substantially improve the peasants' lot. The shift in the patterns of land ownership, most significantly the transfer from crown lands to private ownership, reduced the state's direct control over properties that for generations had been assigned as toyuls to government servants and beneficiaries. Other incentives, especially the production and export of cash crops, did not substantially increase the state's revenue from the agricultural sector. Like most non-Western societies of the time, Iran simply did not generate a substantial volume of wealth comparable to that of the industrial world. Beyond cash crops that could be marketed abroad to earn currency and the foreign trade that enriched a handful of Iranian merchants, but mostly European firms and their subsidiaries in the import-export trade, no other sector promised a major source of income. The bazaar chronically suffered from decline in traditional manufacturing and loss of market share to European imports, especially for textiles, metals, and luxury goods. Foreign trade was brisk, and merchants engaged in it were the chief beneficiaries. In the second half of the 19th century, opium and tobacco increasingly came to dominate the export market and helped maintain Iran's fragile balance of foreign trade. Only from the 1870s did the Persian carpet industry offer a viable export alternative to agricultural commodities. The export of Persian carpets to the United States, Europe, and Russia remained mostly in the hands of English and Italian firms, or Greek and Armenian subjects of the Ottoman Empire. To the elite of the Nasseri period, however, any concerted effort to industrialize appeared untenable. A program of introducing modern industries, even remotely comparable to that of Meiji Japan or the Khedivite period in Egypt, was perceived as unrealistic. Nasser ad-Din Shah simply could not see the advantage, and there were good reasons for his technophobia. Lack of capital, either in the private or the public sector, was the most obvious. The urge to industrialize was absent from the Qajar's reform agenda, since most reform-minded statesmen of the period continued to advocate for reorganization of the machinery of the state rather than expanding the country's economic base. The few efforts under Amir Kabir, and later under Mushir ad-Dowleh, to establish small-scale industries, such as candle-making, glassworks, and sugar refineries, were short-lived. Inept management and inadequate capital played a role, but so did the absence of an industrial infrastructure. A trade-oriented market economy, as opposed to an industrial economy, was traditionally held as the accepted, even revered, norm. Private capital was perceived as being far better invested in foreign and domestic trade than in industry. Even the surplus capital from trade, which was substantial, was reinvested in agriculture or money lending rather than in the risky business of factory-based industries. The merchant capital that financed much of the small-scale local industries in and around the bazaar, such as textile looms, never grew into larger industrial concerns. The high interest rates common in the market, as high as 20% or 25% annually, absorbed much of the merchant's surplus capital. Despite Islam's strict prohibition on usury, merchants borrowed from or acted as moneylenders through such religiously sanctioned practices as the interest-bearing agricultural and commercial loans. Before the establishment of European-style banking in Iran, the Muslim merchants competed with the small-scale Jewish and Zoroastrian moneylenders in one of the few areas that minorities could excel. The chronic paucity of funds, which was in part due to monetary disorders caused by the European export of Iranian precious metals, further added to the sky-high interest rates and, in turn, the shift of excess capital to moneylending. Before the turn of the 20th century, there was a near consensus that Western industries were supreme, and any competition with them would be fierce and insurmountable. And surely British trade policies of the Victorian era knew no bounds in undermining their competition overseas, least of all in a fragile economy such as Iran's. At no time over the course of the Qajar period did European powers encourage the import of new technologies and industries, or allow Iran to adopt policies to protect domestic manufacturing. As far as they were concerned, Iran was a limited but promising export market for European manufactured goods. To reduce the yawning gap in its balance of payments, all Iran could hope for was to export raw materials in exchange for European imports, which in reality meant only a few agricultural commodities, carpets and livestock, especially horses and mules, to British India. The Shah and his advisers were content that Iran was a partner, albeit a minor one, in the world economy. Even the construction of railroad, the backbone of a modern infrastructure, was largely seen as a means of expanding trade rather than creating an industrial base. As demand for market commodities, such as cotton, opium, and tobacco, grew in the international and domestic markets, so did the merchants' direct investments, especially in Fars, Isfahan, and Azerbaijan. Streamlining all stages, from production to processing to wholesale and export, promised a higher rate of return. When it came to the profitable opium trade, Iranian exporters were willing to dodge the British maritime regime and compete with the British opium monopoly in the Chinese market. An enormous increase in the domestic consumption of tobacco also offered new investment opportunities. Increasingly, landowners, among them merchants and mujtahids who purchased crown lands directly from the government or indirectly from fief holders, turned into cash crops, notably because the production of raw silk had been nearly wiped out by diseases. The shift in commodities was one contributing factor to the horrible famine that ravaged Iran between 1869 and 1871, claiming, according to some estimates, more than 1 million lives, or about one-sixth of Iran's population. This was perhaps the greatest calamity to strike Iran in the 19th century. Food shortages during the 1871 famine were compounded by consecutive bad harvests as a result of exceptionally harsh winters. Export of grains to neighboring countries for higher prices also contributed to the shortage. Bread riots and disturbances across the country became more common in response to the mischief of those landowners, prince, governors, wealthy clergy, and the high-ranking officials who hoarded their grain supplies in the pitiless expectation of higher prices. The starving crowds, often with women at the forefront, gathered in the mosques in protest and in front of government houses, cursing the Qajars, the Mojtahids, and the landlords alike, and even attacking and plundering the grain silos. As the famine intensified and food supplies further dwindled, people were forced to eat grass, tree bark, stray dogs and cats, beasts of burden, rodents, crows, and the entrails and blood of slaughtered animals. There were plausible reports, as in Qom, of eating corpses and abduction of young children, mostly orphans, as well as widows and homeless strangers. Even though the starving population mostly viewed recurring famine and ravaging epidemics as acts of divine punishment and fateful calamities, there was also growing resentment toward the state authorities for their indifference and for collaborating with the hoarders. The famine further revealed to the people the government's inability, if not incompetence, to remedy in a meaningful way the misfortunes that had befallen them. The means of relief available to the government were limited. The Shah's decree, Farman, banning the export to Russia of grain produced in the north was largely ignored, and at any rate it would have little impact on the central and southern provinces where the famine was worst. With the famine compounded by raging cholera and banditry, it became almost impossible for the government to transport large quantities of grain on the backs of camels and mules. The Age of Mashira Doleh. The dire situation helped in the appointment in early 1870 of Mirza Hussein Khan Mashira Doleh, 1828-1881, as Sadr Azam. A seasoned diplomat, one who for many years had served as ambassador to the Ottoman court, his rise to power signalled the Shah's periodic return to the idea of reform. First serving as Minister of Justice in 1870, and soon after as Sadr Azam, 1871-1873, Mashara Doleh later intermittently or concomitantly, depending on the Shah's fickle mood or his fear of a conservative revolt, served as Foreign Minister and War Minister. In reality, his wide range of responsibilities turned him into the leading statesman for the rest of the 1870s. Frequent vacillation in Mashira Doleh's posts, no doubt, was because of the Shah's ambivalence to revert to the office of Sadr-e-Azam after a hiatus of 7 years. Hossein Khan Mashira Doleh, who would later receive the title Sepah Salar, Commander-in-Chief of the Army, brought new hopes for the stranded program of institutional reforms, but also posed the danger of monopolizing power. Having served many years in Tiflis, Mumbai, and Istanbul, Mashara Doleh's vision was largely shaped by a centralizing model of state governance through a diplomatic prism. He was a keen observer of the Tanzimat and a close friend of the Ottoman statesmen who presided over it. He was sharp, amicable, and politically skilled, and also corrupt, willing to amass massive wealth at the expense of his professional integrity. By the beginning of the 1870s, there was a new concern, fueled by the British, that Iran and Afghanistan would eventually fall victim to Russian expansionism and become vassalages of the Tsar. As an astute statesman, Mashara Doleh hoped to capitalize on these anxieties. By presenting Iran as a viable buffer state on the road to modernization, he also hoped to overcome the Shah's earlier ambivalence toward reforms and to make gains against the conservative camp. By appointing Mirza Malcolm Khan as the Persian Minister Plenipotentiary to London, he anticipated making a fresh diplomatic start with London. Malcolm's return from exile was followed by the appointment of a number of other reform-minded statesmen, and, to some degree, the opening of the public sphere. All the same, he proved vulnerable to the wishes of the Shah, and unable to ward off the conservatives in the Divan and among the nobility, who eventually outmaneuvered him, just as they had his predecessors. Expanding and streamlining the institutions of the state were the primary objectives of Mashira Dowleh's administration, most significantly in the ministerial divisions, but he also aimed to create a centralized judiciary, a unified fiscal policy, and an efficient army. His efforts to remedy the chaotic divisions between the jurisdiction of the Mujtahid's civil law courts and the Divan's haphazard enforcement of an unwritten customary penal code encountered antagonism from both sides. The ulama opposed even modest measures, such as transparency in boundaries of clerical jurisdiction, or the creation of an administrative sorting house to allot litigation to the appropriate court. The local governors and their judicial officers, especially such powerful prince governors as Masud Mirza Zel al-Sultan in Isfahan, however, viewed centralized supervision as irksome meddling in their prestige and authority. Modernizing Iran's military, to the extent of maintaining a viable force for the purpose of domestic security, also ran into trouble. Despite the Qajars' inflated pride in their military culture and their pretense of power, military reforms ever since Abbas Mirza's new army had been plagued by a host of problems. Old tribal recruitment practices, the haphazard adoption of European military organization and tactics, and discrepancies between the assumed and real strength of the forces were all chronic maladies. Frequent reshuffling and reorganization of the regiments, insufficient training of the troops, old methods of managing the logistics, and misappropriation of military funds by ranking officers compounded to further plague the system. Bickering among Qajar officials, the sale of military posts to unqualified nobility and favorites of the court, and the Shah's inconsistent attention to military affairs also undermined reform. Since the first decade of the 19th century, as the Qajar army lost confidence in its own methods of warfare, the state had placed undue faith in the presumed miracle of European training. Through the course of the century, Qajar Iran employed at least 3 French, 2 British, 2 Austrian, and 1 Italian mission to train its army, not to mention miscellaneous Polish, Prussian, and Italian officers in the Iranian service. Increases in the number of European drill officers, some with questionable skills, encouraged more parades and other illusory exhibitions of military prowess. Condescending attitudes toward Iranian subordinates and undue proximity of some of these hired officers to various European missions in Iran, as well as profiteering through lucrative arms deals, were not uncommon. To be sure, Iran's military rank and file were kept large enough to preserve a semblance of peace and border security. Reasserting Iran's sovereignty over Bandar Abbas in 1868, once the tenancy agreement with the Sultanate of Muscat came to a close, was but one example. The Qajar military also quelled Sheikh Obeidollah's rebellion in northern Kurdistan in 1881. But the cost to maintain an army far exceeded its benefits. Nasser ad-Din Shah and the Ministry of War, first established in 1858, no doubt kept up appearances of supervision and efficiency. Handguns and ammunitions were manufactured in military workshops in Tehran, Tabriz, and elsewhere. European arms consignments, such as a vast number of Austrian Werndl rifles, were purchased at high prices. Barracks and garrisons, even in remote parts of the country, were maintained and their operations monitored. With all the problems that riddled the Qajar army, it was evident that the costly upkeep of a large force served purposes other than sheer domestic security. Beyond serving as a conduit for embezzlement, the sheer prestige and appearance of power helped perpetuate the military. The creation of a small Cossack cavalry regiment, later brigade, in 1879 on the Russian imperial model, manned by a Russian commander, was one of Nasser ad-Din Shah's later military enterprises. Favorably impressed by the Cossacks in the imperial army during his second Russian tour in 1878, the Shah may have intended to counter Mashira Dowleh's tilt toward the British. The Iranian Cossack force, which by the end of the century included no more than 1,500 personnel, was primarily manned by the Muslim émigrés from the Caucasus and their children. That the commander of the force remained almost entirely loyal to Russia, and often in cahoots with the Russian embassy, raises a question as to the raison d'être of this force. At best, one can attribute it to Nasser ad-Din's policy of keeping the Tsar on his side by offering him an affordable token of friendship. At worst, it was an impulsive blunder that for decades to come would help protect the throne while exposing Iranian subjects to the overbearing conduct of the Cossack commanders and their troops. Beyond the military, Mashur ad-Dowleh's intention was to expose the Shah and the Qajar elite to advances in science and industry. He also sought to attract European capital and technology, build up a viable infrastructure, and facilitate development of Iran's yet unexplored minerals and other natural resources. The most symbolic development, of course, was the construction of a railroad, which was key to the 19th-century notion of progress. The project had remained unfulfilled, largely because of the neighboring power's paranoid wrangling over the strategic repercussions of constructing a trans-Iranian railroad linking the Persian Gulf to the Caspian shore. There was a new air of optimism, though, that the astute and well-connected premier would overcome obstacles standing in the way of Iran's technological progress and facilitate catching up with European civilization. Nasser ad-Din Shah welcomed Mashur ad-Dowleh's overture, primarily because he had been anxious to visit Europe since his youth. He viewed Mashur ad-Dowleh as one statesman capable of negotiating Iran's case internationally and containing the resistance domestically to his travel abroad. Royal tours on behalf of the subjects. To test the waters, the new premier negotiated the Shah's visit to the Shi'i holy cities of Iraq with the Ottoman Sublime Porte. Accompanied by a huge retinue, the Shah's pilgrimage in 1871 was the first time in recent history that any Iranian ruler had left his domain in peacetime. On the Ottoman side, the authorities were apprehensive that a royal visit to the predominantly Shi'i province might cause a flare-up of anti-Ottoman sentiments at the time of great tension. In practice, however, the amicable reception of the royal guest by the capable Ottoman governor, Midhat Pasha, 1822-1884, a friend of Mashur ad-Dowleh with a comparably modernist outlook, demonstrated the advantages of implementing reforms in a neglected Arab province of the Ottoman Empire. The Tanzimat under Midhat had weakened the Shi'i Mujtahid's grip over the civil courts and public life. Although it had added to communal tensions and caused recurring Shi'i unrest, it also had the benefit of undercutting the ulama's hold on the community. There was a lesson to be learned by the Shah. The royal pilgrimage elevated Nasser ad-Din's religious devotion beyond a blemish in the public eye. The Shah's account of his pilgrimage, published in the same year, was no doubt meant to communicate this image to his subjects. As the guest of the Ottoman Sultan, he was revered and respected not only by local authorities, but also by the ulama and the population at large. Throughout his tour, Nasser ad-Din was received as the Shah of Iran and as a king, with an extraterritorial aura and symbolic authority over the Shi'is of Iraq, as when he visited the shrine of Ali, the first Shi'i imam, in Najaf. The treasury of the shrine, that had been walled up since the time of the Wahhabi attack on Shi'i Iraq in 1802, was reopened in his honour. In the Shah's presence, the shrine's treasures, mostly of the Safavid era, were reassessed and listed in a register before the treasury was sealed off again by royal Qajar and Ottoman seals. Standing before the shrine's casket, Zari, he then offered his own diamond hatpin to be placed atop the shrine as a sign of his humility and devotion. The royal pilgrimage went on while the famine of 1870 and 1871 was at its peak. On his way back to Iran, the royal cavalcade camped at the outskirts of the city of Qom, where the Shah witnessed the extent of the human disaster. Upon his departure 2 days later, he ordered 400 kharvar, equal to 120 tons of grain stored in government silos, to be distributed among the city's poor. Nasser ad-Din Shah's subsequent royal European tour in 1873 began at a time when the worst of the famine was over. This and the two ensuing royal European tours in 1878 and 1889 captured much attention at home and abroad, and broke a major taboo. That a Persian ruler, with a pivotal place in the symbolic stability of his kingdom, could travel abroad despite a religious ban on entering lands of non-believers, was a novelty even in the late 19th century. The visit proved to be a successful public relations exercise, consolidating Iran's image abroad as a sovereign state and reasserting its independence during the age of colonial expansion. His royal counterparts in European capitals respectfully received the Shah of Persia as the heir to an ancient civilization that, though possibly diminished in its prowess, still carried some weight. The Shah conveyed an image of grandeur equal to that of his European hosts, capable of holding his own as a wise and independent ruler, weaker and more vulnerable, perhaps, but one who could converse, negotiate, and stand his ground. His success in this endeavour, especially during the 1873 tour, contrasted with earlier setbacks and reminded the Western powers that Iran was not up for grabs in the imperial game, at least not for the time being. The royal trip attracted more attention than the royal visits by Sultan Abd al-Aziz, reigned 1861 to 1876, of the Ottoman Empire, and the Egyptian Khadiv Ismail, reigned 1863 to 1879, which took place about the same time. For Europe's elites and its public, Persia called to mind the biblical Persian Empire of Cyrus the Great and Ahasuerus, presumably Xerxes I of the Achaemenid Empire. It also recalled the land of Zarathustra, the rediscovered wise prophet of the Enlightenment. It invoked the romantic memory of the Persian Empire that once had fought a decisive war with the ancient Greeks and later was a formidable rival to the Roman Empire. This was an empire of which they could see its many archaeological remains displayed in the newly founded museums. This was the Shah whom they knew from classical accounts and modern travel literature. An air of fanfare was attached to such distant memories, as if the Shah and his retinue had turned into a spectacle to be gazed at, teased, and even condescendingly looked upon. Proud Europe was eager to see how this ruler of a distant land, once their formidable nemesis, had adapted to the ways of their civilization, how he followed European mannerisms and etiquette, and how he was astounded by the magnificence of its technological, architectural, military, and communications advances. The Shah was yet another showcase for displaying imperial power, similar to the artifacts and mummies of ancient Egypt and Mesopotamia on display in European and American museums, in the world exhibitions of London, Vienna, Paris, and Chicago. He was a living testimony, complementing the statues and memorials that glorify the heroes of colonial exploits. Sailing through the Caspian Sea to the port of Astrakhan, the royal company visited Moscow and St. Petersburg, the first major stops on a long journey that between April and September 1873 included Prussia, the Rhine Valley, Belgium, Britain, mostly London and Manchester, France, Switzerland, Italy, and Austria, then via Istanbul and Georgia, back to the Caspian port of Anzali. The Shah's busy schedule throughout his visit included burdensome welcome and farewell ceremonies, military parades, elaborate balls and banquets, as well as visits to barracks, cannon foundries, and ammunition factories. There was enough time, however, to also stroll in parks, go to concert halls and opera houses, visit museums, see London's Crystal Palace and the Vienna World Exhibition, and tour hunting grounds. Fire engine drills, fireworks, rides on trains and carriages, and horseback excursions all proved amusing, and throughout the Shah maintained his royal comportment with dignity. Customs and appearances of nobility, and such novelties as electrical lighting, steamships, railroad stations, hotels with hot and cold water, circuses, concert halls, and brass bands fascinated him. He was as majestic in calling upon Tsar Alexander II, Queen Victoria, and Emperor Franz Josef as he was astute in negotiating with English, Russian, and French statesmen. In Berlin, he attended the coronation of Wilhelm I, as first emperor of the United Germany, and had two long conversations with the architect of the new empire, Otto von Bismarck, the substance of which remained unknown to the readers of the Shah's published diary. He marvelled at the Chancellor's political skill in piloting a divided Germany into a united empire of great power. What emerged from the European visit was not exactly what Monsieur al-Dowleh had in mind. Nasser al-Din and the princes, ranking statesmen and senior court officials who were accompanying him, could appreciate the advantages of a strong state over the revolutionary alternative that was then in progress. Beyond Russia, the Shah could see the advancements and military glory of autocratic Prussia becoming the German Empire, as opposed to defeated and revolutionary-stricken France. In July 1873, the Shah described in his diary the ruinous outcome of the Franco-German War, the melancholic mood of the people, divisions within the Paris Commune, including the Red Republicans, and the material destruction that turned palaces and government buildings into rubble. His observations of England did not persuade the Shah to substantially transform his own country's political order. He witnessed English democracy in action with its bicameral parliament, judicial independence, government accountability, and, above all, limitations on the monarchy. He was an avid reader of history and knew about the English Civil War and the fate of Charles I. Yet he preferred to focus on those aspects of government that were in harmony with his own vision. In effect, he and many of his contemporaries among the Qajar elite self-servingly internalized an assumption that the gap in political culture with Europe was unbridgeable. Europe, unlike Iran, so the Shah believed, did not have restive tribes on its periphery, nor did it have an intransigent clergy wielding its power over the state with the weapon of Sharia. Upon his July 1873 visit to the Palace of Westminster, the Shah's description of the House of Commons was brief and devoid of any apparent interest in parliamentary deliberation, at least in the printed version of his diary. Lord Gladstone, Disraeli, and the other ministers, Whig and Tory, were present. The Whigs were seated on one side of the House, the Tories on the other side. They brought forward a question on which there was a difference of opinion. The President, Speaker of the House, adjudged according to the majority, that is, the greater number, the lesser number being called the minority. The whole of the members went forth to be counted outside. The place of assembly remained vacant, no one being left except the President. After a minute or so, they came back. The Whigs were the victorious party, who now hold office. Then Lord Gladstone, the Premier, came up to us, and we had a little conversation. It is difficult to see how much the Shah was impressed with the display of the British parliamentary debate, but whatever his opinion, the orderly fashion in which the Whigs and the Tories abided by the vote of the majority could not have escaped his notice. Perhaps it wasn't sheer coincidence that after his return to Iran, the dividing line between conservative and reformist factions in the Shah's government became more pronounced. It was as if he had recognized even more clearly the need to strike some form of balance between the two factions. Yet at no time did he go so far as granting any of the government consultative councils that he periodically convened, and then dissolved, the authority to conduct affairs of the state free of his personal control. Likewise, while the Shah was impressed with Europe's material culture, he hardly was convinced to build an industrial base in his own country, at least not along the lines that reformists of his time wished would happen instantaneously. An imported modernity seemed to the Shah, and to like-minded Iranian elites, untenable. Who, after all, would wish to recreate, so the Shah must have reckoned, the suffocating, polluted, poverty-stricken, regimented, revolution-ripe, smokestack-filled urban environment of the kind he saw in places like industrial Yorkshire or the Ruhr Valley? He surely did not wish to add to the existing problems of his country a set of new ones by creating manufacturing plants for which he did not have, or remotely hoped to have, capital or know-how. And Imperial Europe of the late 19th century was not generous in sharing its jealously guarded knowledge with others, nor would it abandon its long-nurtured export markets. The lure of Europe's material culture, though, knew no bounds. The more the Shah and his company travelled, the more they were charmed by urban spaces, royal gardens, palaces, and public buildings, as well as by European modes and manners, especially timekeeping, dress, and appearance, as well as the ease of travel and communication, the variety of foods and produce, and, of course, the presence of women in public life. The latter created a moral crisis of sorts for the Shah and his retinue. Not accustomed to encountering unveiled women outside their own harems, here members of the royal party were obliged to mingle happily not only with women of royalty and nobility, who conversed with them intelligently and freely, but also with female opera singers, ballerinas, popular performers, circus girls, and prostitutes, as well as ordinary women in the streets and parks. The presence of women in the public space was in sharp contrast to the limitations on Iranian women of all classes. An incident involving a senior wife of the Shah is a case in point. Fatema Sultan Khanum Lavasani, better known by her title Anis al-Dawla, companion of the state, an influential and astute favourite of the Shah from humble origins, who had risen in the harem to become his chief wife and advisor, a de facto queen to the Shah, persuaded Nasser ad-Din to include her in the 1873 European tour. Surrounded by her female attendants, Anis al-Dawla, who was receptive to European ways and most likely prepared to adapt to them, reached as far as Moscow, all along covered with a facial veil and segregated from the men. However, once in the Russian capital, it became apparent that the Shah's wife could no longer stay out of sight, for the Tsar and Tsarina insisted that she be present and unveiled at official functions. Facing the dilemma of Russian court protocol, there was little alternative to the Shah but to send Anis al-Dawla home. She complied, but with bitter dismay, holding Mashir al-Dawla responsible for the disgraceful termination of her visit. It is not difficult to imagine, however, the dire consequences of the ulama's disapproval back home should a royal wife be unveiled in the land of Farang. Back in Tehran, Anis al-Dawla retaliated by participating in a palace coup involving Qajar princes and Tehran mujtahids, which, upon the Shah's return, led to the temporary dismissal of Mashir al-Dawla. Saving the royal honour that was safely protected back home did not stop the Shah from indulging in the world of carnal pleasure. Among other escapades, he purchased a Circassian, or possibly Chechen, slave girl as a portable pleasure companion. Her disguise as a page boy in the Shah's retinue became an open secret and something of an embarrassment. In his 1878 private tour and his official state visit in 1889, Nasser ad-Din Shah met more statesmen, royalty, concessionaires, and celebrities. He visited more palaces, manors, arms factories and barracks, parks and hunting grounds, operas and music halls, museums and zoos. He attended both the 1878 and 1889 Paris World Expositions. The Shah's published diaries, especially that of the 1873 visit, no doubt were intended to remind his subjects of the esteem and attention he received, especially in Russia and Britain. They were part of a public relations exercise to buttress the royal image at home and abroad. The diaries also narrated to his subjects the spectacular farang the king had observed on their behalf. The Shah's simple and unencumbered Persian brought to life, almost like a camera, the momentous and the mundane. As much as the Shah's journals were masterful in describing novelties, they were devoid of depth, let alone critical reflection, as if meant to see but not observe. A sense of envious inaccessibility, moreover, is most evident in the journals in their descriptions of voluptuous fair ladies, powdered, bejewelled, fragranced, and revealing. In contrast to the aesthetic values and mores he was accustomed to, the Western women he met conversed, smiled, danced, and even courted in public. Fascination with Farang permeated even through the controlled tone of the closely edited published version of the diaries.